and looking at the propositions developed by William Henry Green, B.B. Warfield, in their discussion of this question in the two articles that we mentioned in the last class hour. And I've given you, trying to summarize their articles, four propositions, the last of which was the numbers introduced into these genealogies may give an impression of having chronological significance, but in reality they have no bearing on this. They simply serve to indicate lifespan and age at which childbearing began. So picking up from that point, let's go on to five. If you total the years, in Genesis 11, using them for the purpose of chronology, then Shem would still be living in the time of Abraham. And from the flood to Abraham would be 292 years. In other words, if you use the Genesis 11 genealogy for chronological purposes and work down the genealogy in this kind of fashion, here's Shem, and then the second link, work it this way. At a certain age, Shem gives birth to a son, and then at a certain age, that son gives birth to a son, and so forth on down. You see, if you add these up, those periods of time, Shem's life up to that point, and then you see it just followed on down, and total them up, you get 292 years. Now that seems very unlikely from the biblical record. See, it would work this way. If you use the genealogy for a non-gap chronology, which was the thing that was often done, Noah to Abraham. We'd start here with Shem after the flood. 2 years after the flood, Shem gives birth to, or becomes the ancestor of, as we discussed in the last class hour, Arphaxad. So you take the two, and then the 35, the 30, 34, 30, 38, so you step it on down. You have 10 links there. The total would come out to that point when Abraham was born, 292 years. Now this 1656 is on the assumption that you have behind that Genesis 5 from Adam to Noah, and you've done the same thing with that. It would be 1656 years from creation down to this point. And then you step it on down. It's only 292 years from the flood to Abraham. Now, reflect a minute on the biblical material about Abraham. He's called out of Ur of the Chaldees, out of a heathen background, and told to go to Haran, eventually told to come down in the land of Canaan. The Bible gives no indication of others from the ark still living. Now look, Noah, on this basis, would have been alive well into the time of Abraham, because Noah lived 350 years after the flood. And Shem himself, Noah's son, would have outlived Abraham. Abraham was 175 years old when he died. And Shem gave birth to Arphaxad 2 years after the flood, continued to live 502 years. And almost every one of these individuals, in fact, every one of them, would have been alive during the lifetime of Abraham. All those links, all the way down through. And we don't get any indication in the Bible that that was the picture of the time. Yeah.
Well, this is sounding naive. The silence of Scripture was the problem with that.
All right. Yeah. Well, I'm going to go a bit further. Next problem is, 1,000 years before the time of Abraham, approximately 2000 BC, There's no evidence of a flood in Mesopotamia of the scale indicated by the Genesis flood account. We've discovered in the settlements in Mesopotamia, the village settlements, the cities, the civilizations, successive layers that can be traced back. And there's no indication of an interruption of a flood of a sort. There are flood deposits, but they're local little things. You know, at one time here and another time somewhere else. Not any kind of general flood that affected all civilization within not only 1,000 years, but even prior to that. But the point is, you go back, you have civilizations fairly well established by 3000 BC in Mesopotamia. And you can trace successive developments of that civilization without any interruption. So that the same is true in Egypt. Egypt can be traced back in their civilization even longer than the 3000, back to 4000 or so. No indication of interruption of the flood. So you just don't have the time if you want to place that flood in that sort of a historical period. Only 292 years between Noah and Abraham, you don't have it. Warfield says, page 247, of the two genealogies, but particularly this last one, their symmetrical arrangement in groups of 10, they're both 10 links, Genesis 5 and Genesis 11, is indicative of their compression. And for aught we know, instead of 20 generations in some 2,000 years, measuring the interval between the creation and the birth of Abraham, 200 generations and something like 20,000 years, or even 2,000 generations and something like 200,000 years may have intervened. Now, he's not trying to set a date. In fact, Warfield really thinks, as far as the antiquity of some of these things, that it's less far back than some other people do. But what he's establishing is the principle that you can't set that from the biblical information. You can't specify, well, it was at this date, or it could only go to this limit, it couldn't go to that limit. It's all speculative because of the nature of the material you're working with. The Bible does not give us the data to place dates, either on creation of man or on the flood. Which are the two points which are the crucial points. So he says, in a word, the scriptural data leave us wholly without guidance in estimating the time which elapsed between the creation of the world and the deluge, and between the deluge and the call of Abraham. So far as the scripture assertions are concerned, we may suppose any length of time to have intervened between these events which may otherwise appear reasonable. That's a key statement, and I think that's the heart of the issue. As far as the scripture is concerned, we may suppose any length of time to have intervened between these events which may otherwise appear reasonable. In other words, if you want to establish a date for creation, you want to establish a date for the flood, you're going to have to do that with data other than biblical data. And whatever that other data may suggest is the evidence you have to go on. It is not a theological issue, and it's not a problem of biblical interpretation per se, because the biblical materials don't address it. It's only if you are going to force this genealogical material into a chronological purpose that you can have the scripture addressing this issue. And since it doesn't, then you have to settle the problem with extra-biblical data, whatever that may be. And of course, I'm sure you're aware, when you get into this question, you get the young earth people, the old earth people, which isn't so much speaking about date of the origin of man, it's the date of creation. But you push, see, the genealogy works from Adam to Noah. At what point in time did man appear on the earth compared to when the earth was created? That's a whole other question. But you get the young earth people and the old earth people, and they argue that you get into flood geology versus more traditional attempts at interpreting the geological strata in the earth and what the kinds of time frames are involved in that. I think that debate, certainly legitimate, but it has to be carried on its own merits of the validity of the kind of reasoning and evidence that's brought to bear from those disciplines. It's not a theological question or an exegetical question. Questions on that? Discussion on that? We'll come back to that a bit later, but for this point, I think what Warfield and Green are saying that to me is significant is that these questions of date of creation, date of the flood, are not theological issues. They cannot be settled by biblical data. Therefore, it's an open question. Because it's an open question, however, I think we need to be very careful about making someone's view of date of creation or date of the flood some kind of test of orthodoxy or of biblical faithfulness, because I think they're right. Scripture doesn't address it. Therefore, it's not a theological question.
Is it fair to say that a legitimate theological question is whether there was a flood that covered the whole earth? Don't some of those people still have that in a debate?
Yeah.
It seems very clear in Scripture.
Yeah.
In my opinion, Scripture speaks very clearly
that
there was a flood that covered the whole world.
Yeah. We'll discuss that when we get to Genesis.
Not like when it happened, but there should be evidence that there had been a worldwide flood.
Yeah. All right. I think you have a good point. And what you say is true, that among people who discuss this, some of them will localize the flood. We'll discuss that further when we get
to
Genesis.
That's theological.
Depends on how you argue it. We'll have to look at the language of Genesis 6 to 9. I'm inclined to say that what you just said, that Genesis 6 to 9 presents a global flood, but I'm not inclined to base that on what you just based it on, that all the earth was covered. Because there you get into an argument about what the term all means. Is it all within a certain circumscribed frame of reference? And we'll look at some texts to follow that out, because there are other places where it says, you count when Joseph was administering the food in Egypt. It says, all the nations of the earth came to him for food. And it's the same kind of phraseology that's used with the flood. Now, what did we say? That people were coming from China to buy food of Joseph? I don't think so. I think it's all the countries within that eastern Mediterranean region. So I think you have to be careful on what you base an argument for a global flood on the language you see. And it gets into that question, which we will discuss further. Although I'll just say at this point, I'm inclined to agree with you. I think there was a global flood. Then the next question is, geologically, straight it, where's the evidence for it? I can't tell you that, because I don't. I have not ever seen anybody point to the geologic evidence for that other than, and we're getting into a whole other issue here, other than the flood geologists, like Whitcomb and Morris, who are the most popular advocates of that, who say that the entire crust of the earth, with all the strata, are to be explained by the one-year flood. And so where's the evidence of the flood? The entire geologic record is the evidence of the flood. And the proponents of flood geology argue for that. Now, that's another question, whether that is a convincing argument. That's a scientific matter. It's not a biblical matter again. See, we're outside of... There's nothing in Genesis 6 to 9 that talks about flood geology. So when you argue that, see, it's, again, not a theological issue. It's an argument between geologists and how you interpret these strata, how they were deposited, what the evidence is that come to one conclusion, what the evidence is that come to the other conclusion. We'll come back to that. I'm not going to discuss that in any detail because I'm not a geologist. And there's where you get yourself at the mercy of the experts. But I've read some of that stuff. I'm inclined to think that the flood geology has weaknesses. And it doesn't really hold. But then, then where is the evidence? I'm inclined to think it's way back. And maybe evidence has been lost in the course of time. with erosion, various factors, that we just don't have the, you know, we can't point to the strait and say, here's a flood. But to me, that doesn't mean there wasn't a worldwide flood. I think there was, on the basis of the strait. That's kind of an aside. But,
if you take what we've been discussing so far and say that the Bible doesn't seem to suggest the shortness of man's existence on Earth, do we then go to the other extreme and say that man could have been here millions of years?
I'd say you go with, I would go with this last statement of Warfield. We may suppose any length of time to have intervened which may otherwise appear reasonable. So whatever evidence there is that can be turned up scientifically that addresses that issue, that's valid as long as it rests on a good basis and can be established. So the Bible doesn't address the issue. Any conclusion you draw is going to have to be based on extra-biblical evidence, and you can take that evidence wherever it leads you.
Would that be opening the back door to the evolutionary theory of man?
I don't think so. I think the assumption has often been that if you allow for long periods of time, the reason for doing it is to accommodate evolutionists. And I think you can reverse the thing and say that if there weren't long periods of time, the evolutionary theory failed. It must fail. But on the other hand, you cannot say just because there are long periods of time, you must accept evolution. I don't accept evolution. And there are many others who don't, who do accept long periods of time for the presence of man on Earth.
But is that the way you're giving them the grounds for the argument?
Well, one factor. That's one factor, time. But that's by no means the only factor. A lot of other things that have to work together.
So you concede time but not accept change?
Yes, right. Yes.
How does this... Is this genealogy unique? By that I mean, how does it compare to other writings of this other writings of this period?
Well,
the readers have understood this to be to have gaps, and do they have seen the parallelism in the genealogy?
I think you would say that. See, until scientific discovery began to examine things like strata in the earth and to get ideas about time, and of course evolutionary theory arose and all that. Until all those questions arose, nobody really paid that much attention to these things. In other words, the scientific data, and I'm not including evolutionary in that, but scientific data has compelled people to look closer at the biblical material and to reflect on it more. And I think that has certainly been a factor in coming to an understanding that this doesn't necessarily mean a non-gap chronology. So, you see, you don't want science to rule over Scripture in an unwarranted way, but on the other hand, scientific developments can be a motivation to take a closer look at Scripture to see exactly what it says. And when you look at Scripture then, you have to be careful not to make it either say more or less than it actually said, and not to read things into it and make assumptions that are invalid that make it say more than it actually says or something different than it actually says. Let's look at what it actually says. And when you look at the terminology that's used, son, bear, beget, you look at other genealogies, you see the general character of biblical genealogies is the trace line of descent, you see the general character is compression, not full discussion. Well then, I think that is a natural conclusion. We need not force these genealogies into just 10 links.
I guess that was my question. How does this compare to the general character of genealogy? Do we have anything extra biblical?
Not from this period of time that I'm aware of.
No. This period of biblical genealogies.
No. And in fact, I think you have king list in Babylon, which would be much later than this. But as far as I'm aware, you see, this kind of interest in line of descent is something uniquely biblical in this period of history. B on your sheet is a few additional considerations. Some of this we've already touched on. But first, just for sake of argument, if you take the traditional date for creation, comes out of a use of these genealogies for chronological purposes at about 4000 B.C. And from what I already said, we know there were developed civilizations in Egypt and Mesopotamia at 3000. From these civilizations at 3000, you know that both the flood and the confusion of language at the Tower of Babel had to have taken place prior to that. There wasn't uniformity of language in those Mesopotamian cultures, Egyptian culture. So that all had to, the flood and the confusion of tongues at the Tower of Babel had to have taken place prior to that. And then if you take a non-gap chronology of, which I already mentioned, I didn't show you this chart, of Genesis 5, the same thing we did with Genesis 11 a minute ago, from Adam to Noah. See, if you step that down, you're going to, if you put creation at zero, you're going to come up to the flood at 1656. So if you have 3,000 years here, and 1656, you're already at 4656. See, you already don't have enough time. And I've used the most conservative possible kinds of figures there. So there's just no way you can fit it. Now, do you then conclude there's a conflict between scripture and historical knowledge? I don't think so. There were village settlements in Mesopotamia as early as 5000 B.C. I just put 3 there. But there were village settlements as early as 5000 B.C. No evidence of an intervening flood. What's the conclusion? Not that there's a conflict between science and scripture, but that this is not the proper use to put these genealogies. They're not intended to serve as chronologies. Now, back in the late 1800s, I believe it was, people faced this problem initially. Some interesting ways. This book is an interesting book. It's a very anti-Christian book called The History of the Warfare of Science with Theology in Christendom by Andrew Dixon White. And he sort of summarizes here all the ways in which science and the Bible had clashed. And of course, he's of the conviction that science has proved the Bible to be unreliable. But he discusses this thing of chronology. Page 201, I think this is on your... No, I guess I didn't include this on your bibliography. Let me see. No, it's not. It's not. But on page 201 of this book by Andrew Dixon White, The History of the Warfare of Science with Theology in Christendom, he says... It became evident that whatever system of scriptural chronology was adopted, Egypt was the seat of a flourishing civilization at a period before the flood of Noah, and that no such flood had interrupted it. He says this was bad, but worse remained behind. It was soon clear that the civilization of Egypt began earlier than the time assigned for the creation of man. Even according to the most liberal of sacred chronologists. And you see, that was working on the old kind of a chronology system, utilizing these things for chronology. And people began to become aware of that. Well, what did they do with it? Well, he cites one interesting example. Page 232, he says... That a Mr. Southall showing great ingenuity and learning. In his book published in 1875, entitled The Recent Origin of the World, grapples with the difficulties presented by the early date of Egyptian civilization. And the keynote of his argument is the statement made by an eminent Egyptologist at a period before modern archaeological discoveries were well understood, that, quote, Egypt laughs the idea of a rude stone age, a polished stone age, a bronze age, an iron age to scorn. Mr. Southall's method was substantially that of the late excellent Mr. Gasse in geology. Mr. Gasse, as the readers of this work may remember, felt obliged, in the supposed interests of Genesis, to urge that safety to men's souls might be found in believing that 6,000 years ago, the Almighty, for some inscrutable purpose, suddenly set Niagara pouring very near the spot where it is pouring now, laid the various strata, sprinkled the fossils through them like plums through a pudding, scratched the glacial grooves upon the rocks, did a vast multitude of things, subtle and cunning, little and great, in all parts of the world, required to delude geologists of modern times into the conviction that all these things were the result of steady progress through long epochs. In other words, you know, creation with the appearance of age. That was a solution to the geological problem. White says, on a similar plan, Mr. Southall proposed, in the very beginning of his book, as a final solution of the problem, the declaration that Egypt, with its high civilization, in a time of Mena, with its races, classes, institutions, arrangements, language, monuments, all indicating an evolution through a vast previous history, was a sudden creation, which came fully made from the hands of the Creator. To use his own words, the Egyptians had no Stone Age, they were born civilized. So, that's just one illustration of an early attempt to try to harmonize. And I don't think it becomes very convincing. The tragedy of the thing is, you're not forced to that, you see. You don't have to do that kind of thing, because it is based on a misunderstanding of the purpose for which this material in Genesis 5 and Genesis 11 was placed in Scripture. And I think Warfield and William Henry Green, saying this is not a theological issue, the Scripture does not settle this for us, have eliminated all that kind of a problem. And not only, as far as I'm concerned, with the civilization issue with respect to time, but also with respect to the geological problem. That's one additional consideration. Second, very closely related to it, in Genesis 10, you have a table of nations which traces the geographical distribution of people from Noah's three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And if you look at Genesis 10, now interestingly enough, Genesis 10 is put between the end of the flood and before the Tower of Babel. Although what's described in Genesis 10 is obviously pertaining to what conditions were subsequent to the Tower of Babel. In other words, all these nations, languages, and tongues didn't exist till after Babel, but the point of including it prior to chapter 11 is simply that at the end of chapter 9, you have reference to Shem, Ham, and Japheth, the three sons of Noah, and here it's going to trace out what the outcome of the three sons of Noah is, and how different peoples were settled in different places as descendants of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. If you look just, for example, at 10:21 and following, sons were born to Shem, whose oldest brother was Japheth. Shem was the ancestor of all the sons of Eber. The sons of Shem, Elam, Asher, Arphaxad, Lud, and Aram, the sons of Aram, Uz, Hul, Gether, Meshech. Arphaxad was the father of Shelah, Shelah the father of Eber. From Shem come such peoples as Asher and Elam, for example. Those were groups of people that lived long before the time of Abraham. They had their own languages. They were developed as peoples and nations with tongues that differed. Again, if you take this non-gap chronology of Genesis 11 and you only have 292 years between the end of the flood and the birth of Abraham, how could all of these nations and peoples and languages develop in 292 years? It just doesn't fit there. The Elamites were a strong people long before 2000 BC. As were the people of Asher. One third consideration, the Bible does not combine the numbers of the years in the genealogy. In other words, it doesn't add them up and say from Shem to Abraham is 292 years. It doesn't do that. It doesn't give you a total. It seems to me if the purpose was chronology, you would get a total. In the census figures of Numbers, I alluded to in the last class hours, you get how many males 20 years old enough or what they were in each of the tribes, and at the end you get a total. It does total them up. Here you don't have that. So I think that also suggests that that was not the intent. Okay, any questions, comments? Yes.
Yeah, I was looking yesterday at Matthew chapter 1.
Yeah.
There in verse 16, you do have numbers in there, and it's up to you, up to you. Exactly.
Okay. Well, that's another problem. In Matthew 1, verses 2 to 17, I believe, you get that original brief thing, Jesus Christ, the Son of David, Son of Abraham, expanded into 42 links, divided into 3 units of 14 each. So it's schematic. If you compare, for example, verse 8, Asa the father of Jehoshaphat, Jehoshaphat father of Jehoram, Jehoram the father of Uzzah, or Uzziah, if you compare verse 8 with the Old Testament, you see that 3 kings are passed over, and Jehoram is said to have begotten Uzziah, Jehoram the father of Uzziah. Uzziah, in reality, was a great-great-grandson of Jehoram. So again, the use of begat must mean became the ancestor of. But then that has another implication, because if you go to verse 17, you read, thus were there 14 generations in all from Abraham to David. And 14 from David to the exile to Babylon, and 14 from the exile to Christ. The all there, I don't think can mean all the generations that actually lived. It must mean all those enumerated by Matthew in this schematic arrangement. I don't know what else you can do with it, because you clearly can compare verse 8 with the Old Testament, 2 Kings 8:24, and you find that Joram's son, 2 Kings 8:24, was not Uzziah, was Ahaziah. And Joash was the son of Ahaziah, and Amaziah was the son of Joash, and then Uzziah comes as the son of Amaziah. Any other questions? Okay, let's go on to 3, Roman 3. The world before Abraham. The primeval history, Genesis 1 through chapter 11. Just a couple comments generally about Genesis 1 to 11. In Genesis 1 to 11, we are concerned with events prior to otherwise recorded history. We're concerned with events prior to otherwise recorded history. When you get to Genesis 12, you're in the time of Abraham. And Abraham lives at a time when biblical history can be correlated with secular history. And he lives in a time in which we have sources other than the Bible, historical sources. But in Genesis 1 to 11, we're dealing with things that happened in a time prior to otherwise recorded history, outside the Bible. And at the same time, we're dealing in Genesis 1 to 11 with some of the most basic questions of human existence, and particularly in chapters 1 to 3, with creation and the fall, and then also in chapter 11 with the development of different languages, distribution of peoples. So that I think we can say, particularly with Genesis 1 to 3, but also generally with Genesis 1 to 11, that we have some of the most important chapters in the entire Bible in this early part of Genesis. So let's begin to look at it, and we'll begin to deal here with the biblical text. A is the creation of the universe in Genesis 1, 1 to 2, 3. Now just to comment on that particular division of material, 1, 1 to 2, 3. I didn't make the break at the end of chapter 1. I carried it over into chapter 2 to the third verse. Chapter 1 has, 31 verses. As you're aware, I'm sure, chapter verse divisions were not something original with the biblical text. They've been inserted subsequently, and in many cases, you can find better breaking points than the ones that traditionally have been followed. And a better dividing place for the first section of Genesis is at 2-3. The reason for that is verse 4 of Genesis begins with a phrase that becomes the phrase that structures the rest of the book. And that phrase is, these are the generations of, in the King James, the heavens and the earth. NIV, of which I'm looking at, says, this is the account of the heavens and the earth. What you have as far as the structure of the book of Genesis is you have creation in 1-1, 2-3, and you could say that's the first section of the book. The second section of the book would be 2-4 to the end of the book. And that is divided into 10 sections. Each one introduced with the phrase, these are the generations of. And the first one of those sections begins there at 2-4. See, the 2-4 you have, these are generations of heaven and earth. The second section begins at 5-1. These are the generations of Adam. And 6-9 is the third one. These are the generations of Noah. Now, NIV says this is the account of Noah. We'll discuss that phrase later. But my point here is, structurally speaking, the book of Genesis falls into those blocks of material introduced by that phrase regularly through the book. So it's better to make that your dividing point for the first section. And not only is it a dividing point for the first section, it's sort of set off from the rest of the book as an introductory section of great importance, creation. So you have the creation of the heavens and the earth in 1-1 to 2-3. Then you have the generations, you might say, that follows in 2-4 through the end of the book, with 10 sections of the generations. All right, one under A is general teaching about God. And you notice what I'm going to do here in 1, 2, and 3 is just give you a sort of summarization of general teaching about God, then general teaching about the universe, then general teaching about mankind. It's found in the first chapter of Genesis. I'm not going to dwell on this in any great detail, but some general principles in these areas that we find in Genesis 1. I might say before doing that, the Wellhausen School and those that follow that JVP analysis assign Genesis 1 to the P document, which is the latest material because it's very sophisticated God concept involved in Genesis chapter 1. It couldn't have been early. It had to be late. So Genesis 1 is P material written in the exile or even after the exile according to the critical school of thought. J. Genesis 2 is assigned to J, which would be the earliest. So you move from a very sophisticated to a more primitive, the most primitive of the material. The reason I said that is I want to discuss that issue when we get to chapter 2, and I just mention it at this point. All right, under general teaching about God, A, God's existence is assumed. God's existence is assumed. Now, that's interesting in itself. If you compare biblical material with extra-biblical mythologies, what you find in extra-biblical mythologies are stories that tell how the gods came into existence themselves. The story that's most often compared with Genesis is the Enuma Elish. We'll talk more about that later. You'll read about it in Finnegan. Enuma Elish is a Babylonian creation story. And in it, you have two principles of living, uncreated matter, Tiamat and Apsu. You don't need to take this down. We'll discuss this later. But it's from Tiamat and Apsu, who were the mother and the father of all the gods, that this whole pantheon of Babylonian deities are born. And then you get all the family intrigues and so forth that develop out of that. Yes?
And this their teaching about God and talking about
reality? No.
Or specifically?
What I think the Bible teaches. What comes out of the text? What comes out of the text? God's existence is assumed, number one. Or A. And you contrast that then with extra-biblical mythologies. And there's an enormous contrast. Because what you read in Genesis 1:1 is that beautiful, majestic statement, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. See, it doesn't tell you anything about how God came into existence. His existence is assumed. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. B, monotheism is presupposed. And to that, or in that sense, it is taught. I wouldn't say there's any explicit theoretical kind of teaching about monotheism in Genesis 1. It's assumed. But in that sense, it is taught. Monotheism is assumed. And in that sense, it is taught. So pretty mentioned, extra-biblical mythology tells of many different gods. You learn of wars and intrigues, battles, killing each other, all that kind of thing. You don't have any hint of that in Genesis 1. There are no other gods mentioned, and it seems like there's no possibility of any other gods. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Now, the interesting thing is, the term God itself,
in Hebrew,
Elohim, some of you are taking beginning Hebrew. Elohim,
that's an A.
Those of you who are taking Hebrew, you recognize that? Him, plural ending, yeah. The word Elohim has a plural ending. It's a plural noun form to designate God. Depending on the context in which that word appears, it can be translated either singular or plural. See, the very same word, Elohim, could be used in the context of the gods of the Canaanites, say, and you would translate it plural with a small g. But that term when used of Israel's God, even though it's a plural noun, it's used with a singular verb and singular modifiers. See, which goes against, you might say, the structure of the language. It's used with a singular verb with singular modifiers. In that first statement, in the beginning, God created. The verb is third masculine singular. Not a plural verb. It's not in the beginning, God's created, even though the noun is a plural form. It's in the beginning, God created. Singular verb. And when modifiers are attached to the noun, when it's used with Israel's God, singular modifiers. Now, see, my time's up. Let me just make a brief statement and we'll dismiss. Some understand that plurality to suggest plurality within the Godhead.